Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Will Stats. I live in Victory, Vermont. And is your name Betty up in the corner?
Yes.
I actually grew up in Middlebury, so.
Oh.
Yeah. I'll go through my testimony. I know we're running behind, and I'll try to be as quick as possible. And I will preface this by saying I don't like reading testimony, but I think I kind of have to do that to just kind of get the
points. Well, we want you to take your time and
thank
and
you.
Make sure that you tell us what you came here to do.
Great. Thank you very much. So my name is Will Stats, and I live in the Northeast Kingdom town of Victory, Vermont. I am a certified wildlife biologist and also run a small guide business in my spare time. I'm an avid hunter-trapper, and I've spent a good portion of my life exploring wild places. For the record, I believe in global warming. It is this very fact that causes me concern about the plight of our sensitive mountain ridgeline habitat. In fact, as the climate warms, these high elevation, these islands of fragile habitat will become even more important. And I've walked hundreds of miles of mountain ridgelines in Vermont, northwestern Maine, and northern New Hampshire. As a young man, I camped along the long trail in Vermont's central Green Mountains, snowshoeing long bobcat and fisher trap lines while sleeping nights in homemade shelters or tent. In my professional career, I have studied and worked in high-elevation forests in northern Vermont and New Hampshire for 30 years. Working for Vermont Fish and Wildlife in the 1980s, I reviewed Act 250 permit applications for timber harvest planned for mountain ridges above 2,500 feet and ski area development projects. I performed wildlife and forest habitat surveys on numerous mountain complexes. As a forester for a large timber company, I supervised logging operations on mountains in northern Vermont. In the 1990s, as a wildlife biologist in New Hampshire, I helped negotiate the high-elevation memorandum of agreement between state agencies, the Appalachian Mountain Club, and numerous landowners, resulting in specific guidelines for timber harvest above 2,700 feet, ultimately protecting sensitive wildlife habitat. My broad experience working in this exceptional environment has provided me with a unique insight and understanding of why we must protect this rare, quickly disappearing type of habitat. I believe this was also recognized years ago by Vermont visionaries who put safeguards in place through Act 250. Sadly, because the projects planned for these habitats, the energy projects planned for these habitats are handled by the Section 248 process, the strong protections of Act 250 are not afforded to these energy projects. For the past 4 years, as in my work as a biologist for the state of New Hampshire, I've been closely involved with the environmental review of a 33-turbine industrial wind turbine project in northern New Hampshire involving four mountain summits. I monitored all phases of this project, including hiking the alignment, reviewing turbine locations, helping to formulate mitigation, and developing pre- and post-construction studies. This project has given me a first-hand knowledge of what a mountain looks like before and after an IWT project, and has helped me better understand the process of proper siting, construction, and resulting effects on the mountain ecosystem. As part of this project, my agency has spearheaded two groundbreaking studies, wildlife studies on the affected mountain ridges, studying the ecology and impacts of the American marten, which is an endangered species in Vermont, and the Bicknell's thrush. These are the very first studies of this kind performed in this habitat involving these species. It is important to emphasize to you folks that many non-government proponents of industrial wind turbine projects have little or no on-the-ground experience in this environment. Frequently, these proponents pay a brief visit only after the wind generation facility is built. One can only truly comprehend the scale of disturbance by first visiting an undisturbed mountain ecosystem and then being present for all phases of construction from the design to the finished operation. In short, an after-the-fact bus tour cannot begin to reveal the story of these projects as they unfold. Due to the rapid increase in wind development projects in the Northeast, wildlife biologists and natural resource managers are expressing their growing concerns regarding large-scale wind development and its impacts to sensitive habitat and the wildlife that inhabit these areas. While high-elevation land, 2,500 feet and higher, is a scarce resource in the Northeast and is limited to approximately 3% of Vermont's total land area, and I'll show you a map of that in a minute. Concerns for the sensitivity of this habitat obviously prompted Vermont to enact the Tough Development Law Act 250, which requires a permit for any activity occurring above 2,500 feet, including timber harvest. So wildlife is impacted by industrial wind development at various levels. At a forest stand level, forest cover is removed and permanently lost for some species due to the project footprint. Important wetlands can be compromised or destroyed during construction and headwater, seeps and feeder streams directly impacted. You know, I couldn't help but listen to the discussion on the Shoreline Protection Act, and having been involved with these high elevations for so many years, realizing that they are such a sponge, and that is where our watersheds start. If we want to protect water quality, we need to protect the tops of these mountains. This is where your watersheds start. And then we should, obviously, I've been involved in shoreline protection through my role as a biologist, and that's also very important as well. For birds and bats, turbines pose a new source of mortality in these habitats. At a landscape level, habitat connectivity and resiliency across the forest landscape may be compromised depending on the scale of the project and its context within the surrounding forest land. High elevation forests are unique. They provide stands of trees generally in an older aged condition, interspersed with natural gaps and holes in the forest canopy. Some wildlife use mountain ridge lines as a refuge for more developed areas at lower elevations. For instance, over the years we've handled numerous black bears in their dens at these high elevations where they seek out these undisturbed locations, particularly the male bears. The mountain ridges may be the only undeveloped areas in a region and serve as critical corridors for wide-ranging species, including bobcat, lynx, bears, fisher, and marten. I was at 3,500 feet yesterday and discovered lynx tracks on a mountain that had never been seen before in that particular location until this year. These animals exist more successfully with infrequent human contact. In fact, one of the more rare birds in the Northeast, the bicknell thrush, resides exclusively in high-elevation forests. Many unanswered questions exist regarding the impacts of wind development on wildlife in these sensitive habitats. It will take years to fully understand the impacts. Increased human presence influences the use by wildlife in these habitats. We don't know how the dynamics of predator and prey change due to the edge effects of road cuts or hard-packed snow roads in the winter months, but we're learning. We know that wildlife have hearing far more sensitive than humans, and we heard Stephen's discussion this morning. Nothing was mentioned about wildlife. Wildlife exist because they can hear well. They make their living that way, and so the impact zone due to the noise may be much, much larger, maybe in the thousands of acres. How is this noise impacting wildlife's ability to communicate, hunt, or breed? Our current permitting policies do not allow resource managers and clean energy advocates any time to analyze ongoing wildlife studies before committing to further industrial-scale projects on additional ridgelines. Studies need to evaluate the cumulative impacts of these projects instead of looking at each project in isolation. Biologists understand that it is critical to evaluate the importance of providing connectivity for wildlife across the greater landscape to ensure genetic exchange and access to habitat resources. Industrial wind projects that sprawl across miles of previously undeveloped ridgelines may be fragmenting important forest land habitat far greater than we now realize. Our research in northern New Hampshire has demonstrated, for instance, that turbine access roads built on these remote mountains have become vectors for coyotes and foxes. Maintenance vehicles traveling to and from the turbines continually pack the snow, providing a firm base on which these canines travel from lower elevations to the ridgelines. We have followed tracks of these animals demonstrating this behavior on numerous occasions. Windswept turbine pads and road cuts contribute to the creation of a packed snow surface in the unbroken forest adjacent to these openings. These canine predators can now penetrate the mountain forest where the snow would previously have consisted of a loose, fluffy surface. As a result of the project construction, the ecological community of these forests have been drastically changed, possibly putting additive stressors on the endangered marten, for instance. Necropsies that we performed on our marten research animals revealed that a number of these animals were killed near the project area by coyotes, foxes, and fishers. This research is currently under analysis. It's not finalized, and it's going to be available to the broader public by next year. But this is one of the impacts we begin to detect. There's a lot of questions around that, of course. Wildlife biologists and ecologists are alarmed by global warming and understand the need for sensible, responsible, renewable power. However, given the scarcity and fragility of high elevation habitat, we need to question if these limited mountain ecosystems should even be considered at all as a choice for this type of intrusive development, as our wild lands continue to disappear at an alarming rate through a death by a thousand cuts. We have to ask ourselves, where will our wildlife reside in this ever-shrinking natural landscape? As the climate warms, actually, these complex mountain habitats will actually change slower due to their elevation and will serve as a refuge for species, allowing these animals the ability to adjust and evolve to higher temperatures and changing habitat. To escape more pronounced changes at lower elevations, some species of wildlife will migrate upslope into these higher elevation forests. Our mountain ridgelines will continue to serve as critical corridors for wildlife traveling across the landscape, providing important uninterrupted connections between distinct populations. In fact, the role our mountains will continue to play as a refuge for wildlife will prove their most valuable attribute against climate change, far more valuable than they could ever serve as a site for industrial electricity generation. I mean, let me give you just a quick example. We are very concerned about climate change on moose. Moose heat stress very much. They're adapted to colder climates. They have heavy coats. We're seeing additional stressors to moose, possibly exacerbated by warmer temperatures. These animals winter at high elevations. In warmer temperatures, they're going to move to cooler places. The naturally cool place to go is to the higher ridge lines. That's one example. Marten and lynx, for instance, are snow-dependent animals. They need deep, fluffy snow where they can outcompete other predators like coyotes and foxes. So if, in fact, the climate continues to warm and we have less snow at lower elevations, these high-elevation habitats are going to be that much more important because of this, that snow regime up there. I also want to just mention quickly, I want to dispel a bit of a myth regarding wind power, and that is the notion that Vermonters can recreate near these huge machines. It has been inferred that snowmobiling and hunting can coexist with an industrial wind turbine project, but I can assure you that is the last place one would or should choose to pursue these pastimes. The danger of ice throw cannot be overemphasized. I have often worked near these turbines on our research projects in the winter and witnessed the large divots in the snow where ice has been flung from the turning blades. I've seen the steel stairs leading to the doors of turbines bowed and broken by ice falling from the nacelle. And on one terrifying occasion, my truck was struck by ice that would have killed any one of us that were outside of the truck. One operator at the wind installation said that these things will send a 400-pound chunk of ice 1,000 feet. So I'd also add that having worked near and under these turbines on numerous occasions, I can say with certainty that the noise alone would prevent any sort of enjoyment a Vermonter or anyone else might get out of what was formerly mountain solitude. Back to the noise issue that Stephen referenced. Addressing climate change, we all know, is going to require sacrifice, leadership, and courage. And I believe courage to admit when one is wrong. And I believe industrial wind, as currently proposed, is wrong for Vermont. We should not sacrifice one non-renewable resource, our ridge lines, in the misguided attempt to replace other non-renewable resources. We need to stop groping for symbolic, non-productive solutions as we literally tilt at windmills in our efforts to combat the real threat of global climate change. I want to thank you all for listening to my testimony. I want to show you a couple of pictures here. And I would invite any and all of you, and I say this with sincerity, to accompany me. I would be more than glad to lead you up into some of these mountain ridge lines and show you the type of habitat that's found there. And we can talk about some of these issues further up in the woods, which is a whole lot nicer place to be. I want to show you these maps that were produced by the Wilderness Society. This is high elevation habitat in Vermont. Again, I said there was 3%, and this is attached to the testimony that I'll give out to you. So about 190,000 acres in Vermont, 190,500 acres in Vermont is high elevation habitat. That is above 2,500 feet. Now, that's your starting place. That doesn't say what conditions that's in. Obviously, some portions of it are better than others. There's 13 ski areas in the state that are obviously impacting high elevation habitat in one way or another. So that's your starting point. That's all we have, 3% of Vermont's entire landscape. If we look at what Vermont Fish and Wildlife produced on their habitat quality, this is what Vermont Fish and Wildlife produced, and the Wilderness Society put together in a map. So Vermont's best wind source resources are located in or near the state's largest intact blocks of wildlife habitat. So the darker green is your richest and best wildlife habitat in the state. And you can see it's right along the spine of the Green Mountains in the Northeast Highlands where I live, and in these areas up here. And then finally, big-nose thrush habitat, which is determined of that 190,500 acres. So less than 1% of Vermont, about 51,000 acres, is big-nose thrush habitat. This is one of the rarest birds in the world. It's being considered for the endangered species list. And Vermont is blessed, if you will, to have approximately 8% of the United States' entire breeding habitat in our state. For those of you that don't know what American martin looks like, this is an endangered species. This is in Vermont. This is the face of high elevation habitat in Vermont. It's not that these animals can't live at lower elevations.
Where's the bird?
What's that?
Where's the bird?
No, it's not a bird. It's a mammal. It's a weasel-like animal.
A martin,
yeah. And
it's
on the garbage truck.
Yeah. It's from the city.
Yeah. I think you need to go.
Put a raccoon on there.
I think you need to walk with me. That's right. Just a quick picture. This is some high elevation habitat before a project. A couple of pictures. I could talk a long time about the complexity of this habitat and what makes it unique. And this is that same spot as the development begins to occur, and this is roughly the same spot as the development continues to go on. And then again, a picture of the completed, quite a different look to it. And of course, I haven't even discussed the impacts to reptiles and amphibians, and the salamanders and their ability to cross these impervious surfaces and so on. So I'm open to questions, and I do have 15 copies of this testimony with the maps attached, and you're welcome to. I would point out that the governor recently, I have a letter from the governor where he asked ANR to look at habitat throughout the state and try to identify where the habitat would be most crucial, where those high values are, and it appears that Vermont did that exercise, ANR did that exercise some years in the past, and that was that map that I showed you that shows that high-quality habitat overlaying into many of those places that might be considered for wind development. Not that they all would be, but we're currently faced with a project in the Northeast Kingdom, if I've heard it, Seneca Mountain Wind. That is some very high-quality habitat up there. I'm very familiar with that. I've walked it hundreds of times, and it also is home to the endangered American martin up there. So.
So, Will, thank you.
Sure.
Very
okay.
much. Appreciate it.
And here's those copies, yeah. Mr. Chairman. And
I have some questions for you.
Great, good.
What other types of development are you concerned about as well that may threaten the precious habitat?
From an energy standpoint?
No.
Or
no,
anything?
No.
Oh, any?
Any type?
Yes. Well, anything that has a fragmenting consequence to it. Again, our blocks, our unfragmented blocks of habitat, like I was pointing out here in my testimony, are growing fewer and fewer. We're blessed in Vermont because we've had some really great conservation projects in the past that has preserved large tracts of land. So anything, I've worked with large landowners both in Vermont and New Hampshire for 30 years, and I was part of the Northern Forest Land Study, the 26 million acres of Northern Forest that spreads from New York to Northern Maine. And every time one of these ownerships gets sold, they continue to get fragmented further and further. They get parceled up and broken up. So any kind of development that fragments and inhibits the ability of wildlife to travel across the landscape, we're concerned about, whether it's a highway project. I've reviewed all kinds of things, pipelines in my career as a wildlife biologist. You never know what the next project's going to be and how it's going to be, but anything that fragments these last blocks of habitat are of concern to me.
So are you concerned with the proposed build-out of Burke Mountain, for example?
Yeah, I would certainly be concerned about that. It's interesting. Many years ago when I worked for Vermont Fish and Wildlife, Charles Willie and I walked that entire mountain under Act 250 review for one of their former master plans. So yeah, any ski area development, and I'm actually, to be honest with you, a little surprised about the whereas years ago when we had ski area development expansion, the environmental groups would come out of the corners and stand up with us and so forth and help defend that high elevation mountain habitat, and yet I'm not hearing the same thing from
that. That's the problem I'm having.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other situation that you spoke to, which is every time these large tract owners are getting less and less and less, and the pressures to do something to keep them. My understanding, that's why at least a couple of these projects by the landowners are saying, I can't, you know, the logging's not paying for the...
There's other methods, though. We've always been able to... I've heard that for years, because
right.
I've been involved with large landowners for years and years, and it's usually, if we don't do this, we're going to have to sell the land. Well,
right.
My experience is they generally do sell it anyways,
right.
And we've been lucky as a state to put conservation easements, and that has afforded
right.
them the ability to hold on to the land. There's many other techniques besides
so
that. Yeah.
You take Lowell, for example, okay? Yeah. I think you would agree that if there is a positive side to Lowell from your perspective, it's the 2,700 acres that have been conserved permanently.
Yeah, mitigation, we always fall back on mitigation, but mitigation, it means loss.
Right.
It means something has been lost, and whether those acres really are equivalent to the high elevation acres, generally, yeah. And I don't think they are. I'm just not familiar with Lowell. I didn't work on the project, it's a settlement. Usually, we've done it with our agency. You settle.
Right.
It's what
so
it is. It's settled.
I have two more questions for you, and I already forgot one.
Sorry.
I need to be educated on. I've been to some of these areas before these projects, and I saw remnants of logging operations that was not pretty.
Sure. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And eroded roads
right.
and that couldn't
right.
be good for water quality.
Sure. Yep. Yep.
Is a logging operation, three questions. Is a logging operation, does that fragment habitat?
Not maybe only in a very temporary basis. I mean, if you think about Vermont's mountains, some of them have been logged four times since settlement, and it can depending on how the operation is done, it can be amazingly resilient, and the difference between logging is it's temporal. You know, the trees are going to grow back, and if it's done properly, but I never equate logging with a permanent change in the landscape as a development, whether it's ski area or housing development or some kind of infrastructure from a project. Logging, I always say to folks, when you cut a tree in the forest, it benefits one species of wildlife and it takes something away from another species of wildlife. So it's all how it's done and where it's located and the timing. But logging can be a great friend of wildlife, for sure, in the right places at the right time. You know, my contention is that these high elevation areas, particularly above 2,700 feet, I would rather not see any timber harvest take place. In general, that's kind of where I'm first at, even though we have design techniques where it can be done. That's hence the MOU that we had in New Hampshire with the large landowners that we all agreed to. There are techniques can be done to lessen those impacts, if you will. But as a scientist, I would rather see natural processes take place up there, the natural for waves.
The last thing I want to share with you, and I've shared this with Steve Wright, and I've been very public about it, and I mean it actually from the bottom of my heart. If what you're saying is correct, okay, and I have no reason to doubt what you're saying. And it is, and ridgeline protection is the ultimate goal. Okay, then I will sign on right now that if you want to make that height 2,500 feet, 2,700, if you want to make it 2,000 feet, then I say nowhere in the state of Vermont for any reason that anything that has the negative effect that you're talking about. Be done. And I don't care if it's ski area expansion. I don't care if it's transmission lines.
Sure.
I don't care if it's roads
yeah.
that are
yeah.
already
right.
Above there.
Yeah.
And if that's, as a state, what we mm-hmm. want to do,
right.
I'll lead the charge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What I had difficulty with, and I'm glad you share my skepticism, which is on the proposed development up there. And we don't hear the environmental outcry. I have a problem with That's okay, but that's not.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I know that industrial wind development goes where the wind is, and that's at the higher elevations, but in your opinion, are there areas of Vermont that would be acceptable for large-scale wind?
There may well be. I mean, I'm not anti-wind. It's, my expertise is in these higher elevation, these habitats, these wildlife habitats, and we would have to weigh what sort of impacts they would be where they were developed and so forth. I mean, they're always going to, with any development, you're going to have some kind of impact, and it's how you weigh it against the overall context. I take a close view, and then I take that aerial view. That's why I talked about the stand level, and then the landscape level, looking from 30,000 feet, if you will. How does that fit into our state and our landscape? And in fact, biologists are working on even greater. How does Vermont connect to? I worked with a project with the Nature Conservancy for the past year on staying. It's called Staying Connected, and our object. Years ago, yes.
I'm curious why you think that process would be better than the PSB process, which uses the same standard, the undue adverse impact,
right,
and also uses the same criterion 8A for natural resources. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why you think there are not sufficient protections accorded in the PSB process?
Very good question. I think it's my experience with Act 250, it was a much more rigorous process. It seemed to bring in a much broader range of expertise, like I said, it was a long time ago when I used Act 250 or when I was involved in the Act 250 process here in Vermont. But I do feel that it's a more rigorous process with I've testified before the Public Service Board before. It's a pretty limited group of folks that you're talking to, and that's kind of where I'm coming at from that standpoint.
Yeah. Are you going to stay around?
I'll stay around till the break, probably.
I'd like to talk to you.
Gladly. Great. Thank you.